Have you ever wondered why Nazi Germany hosted the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games, attracting the entire world's attention, even at a time when they were committing atrocious human rights abuses? And have you ever wondered why Saudi Arabia in the present day has embarked on a similar venture? Let's hear from Dr. Jules Boykoff, who recently wrote a book on the 1936 Games titled The 1936 Berlin Olympics, Race, Power, and Sports Washing. Dr. Boykoff is the head of the Politics and Government Department at Pacific University in Oregon. First up, it's Berlin 1936 and Nazism.
Adolf Hitler was not really all that interested in the Olympics, but he was convinced by Goebbels that it would be a great chance to spread the gospel of Nazism far and wide. In fact, organizers of the 1936 Olympics in Berlin started a tradition that has continued all the way through today. That's the Olympic torch relay. So they light the Olympic torch in Greece, in Olympia, and they sort of wended their way through Europe all the way to Germany. And you would see the Olympic rings right next to the Nazi symbology as it traveled across Europe. And so I read Hitler's Mein Kampf. I don't recommend it, but I did it from cover to cover when I was writing this book. And it's interesting how little he talks about sports. He mentions boxing a few times, but he doesn't really talk about the Olympics in Mein Kampf. So it took some convincing from Goebbels, but once Hitler figured it out that in fact Goebbels was right and that this was an incredible source of propaganda, he jumped with both feet into it. He hung out with all the members of the International Olympic Committee, who, by the way, absolutely adored Hitler, gave him positive ratings, said all these positive things about him. The US media, where I'm coming from, the United States right now, the top papers in the United States wrote glowingly of Hitler and the great job he was doing in Germany and the great job he was doing with the Olympics. And so, in short, I would say that Goebbels got it 100% right. The 1936 Olympics in Berlin were an incredible propaganda opportunity for the Germans to spread their ideas far and wide and also to make themselves look positive and deflect attention from some of the downsides, the obvious signs of genocide that were on the way in the country.
The idea for the very first Olympic torch relay was devised by the Nazi Germans, as mentioned earlier by Dr. Jules Boykoff. The very first Olympic torch was manufactured by a company called Krupp, which was a German steel company manufacturing weapons of mass destruction for the Nazis. But this wasn't the only company which was hand in glove with the Nazis.
There have long been dodgy connections between the Olympic Games sponsors and the everyday people in these various Olympic cities. And, you know, you mentioned the Krupp company, but there's other companies that were doing business in Germany at that time as well. I mean, the Nazis were studying how the elimination of the attempts at elimination of sovereignty of native peoples in the United States were happening. In fact, at times, the Nazis thought that the U.S. government had gone too far in terms of curtailing the rights of native people and black people in the country. They were like, whoa, that's too much for us Nazis, basically what was happening in the United States. IBM, the big U.S. company, played a huge role in helping Hitler carry out the genocide. Ford Motor Company, General Motors, these were favorite companies of Hitler. If you went and looked in Hitler's office in 1938, there was a big picture of Henry Ford, who was a notorious anti-Semite.
Speaking of American companies, let's take a look at how the US Olympic contingent, and more specifically, the African American athletes were treated while in Nazi Germany during the Berlin 1936 Olympic Games.
The U.S. team had 18 African-American members on it, 12 of them in track and field. And it was true that they were actually received positively by everyday German people. The German government, on the other hand, was none too happy about this. I mean, if you look at what Hitler had to say about African-Americans in Mein Kampf, it wasn't pretty. He was all about the purity of blood and not racially mixing with other groups. And it was horrible stuff. But the actual German people were intrigued by these 12 athletes, especially in track and field, who were doing so well, and they were treated really well by the German people. That doesn't mean that Hitler and the SS weren't interested in trying to stop those kind of communications. In fact, a special unit was set up to surveil the African-American athletes while they were in the country.
And it wasn't just the Nazis who had a discriminatory mindset.
Well, the IOC, from the very beginning of its origins, has been exhibiting racism left and right. The founder of the modern Olympics, a guy named Baron Pierre de Coubertin, a French aristocrat, he held extraordinarily racist views. He said that if Africans were allowed into the Olympics, it would help them be less lazy and it would help them calm down. He would write things like that. He was also extraordinarily sexist. He didn't think that women should be involved in the Olympic Games unless they were placing the laurels on the heads of the victorious men champions, or if they were producing baby boys that could be Olympians, that was the role that women had to play, according to the Baron, Pierre de Coubertin. And so, you know, the whole Olympic project was founded on racism and sexism and also classism. I mean, in the early days of the Olympics, if you were a bricklayer or, you know, a working class person, you were not allowed to participate. You were considered a professional. Instead, it was you had to be an amateur, which basically meant you had to be a person of leisure. And so that opened the field wide open for these aristocrats to do quite well in the early days of the Olympics. So it should surprise no one, really, given that inglorious history, that the IOC was perfectly open to people like Hitler. And then later, you know, some things don't change. I mean, it's not quite as extreme as it was back then. But the IOC today has no problem handing the Olympics to autocrats. We've seen them do it time and again, even if those places grossly violate the spirit of the Olympic Charter, the International Olympic Committee continues to hand the Olympics to them, arguing that the Olympics are not, in fact, political, as if handing the Olympics to an autocrat is not an act that's political.
Moving on, let's take a look at how Jewish athletes were treated during the Nazi regime, with particular focus on Gretel Bergmann, Germany's best high jumper at that time.
One of the criticisms that was lofted at the Nazis ahead of the 1936 Olympics was that they were not allowing perfectly capable Jewish athletes to join their teams, excluding them on purpose. And in fact, that became a real sticking point for three of the members of the International Olympic Committee who hailed from the United States. They wanted to see Jewish athletes included on the German team. And they put a lot of pressure on the Germans as well as other members of the International Olympic Committee to make that happen. Gretel Bergmann was one of those people who was a top contender, like you're saying. I mean, her jumps were on par with some of the best jumps at those Olympics. And yet she was, at the end of the day, excluded. Funny story, her granddaughter, her name is Molly Lambert. She now lives in Los Angeles, where she is a member of the anti-Olympics group there. She's an activist fighting against the Olympics. And so just kind of a quirky detail of history. Now, the Nazis did allow two Jewish athletes in. Helene Meyer participated in fencing, where she actually won a silver medal. And in fact, when Meyer was on the medal stand, she gave a Nazi Heil salute. The other one was in the Winter Olympics. There was a guy named Rudy Ball who played hockey. He was included in large part because, well, one, he was one of the best players, if not the best player on the team. And two, his teammates said that if he wasn't included on the team, that they weren't going to participate. And so some athlete power standing up for their teammate. But yes, there were only these few token athletes that were Jewish that were included that allowed Hitler to say, look, we don't discriminate against Jewish people, when you could look around everywhere and see literal signs all around Germany saying all these terrible things about Jewish people. In fact, the International Olympic Committee sent a group of people ahead of the Winter Olympics, which happened in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, before the Summer Olympics in Berlin. And they were aghast at some of the obvious nature of these anti-Jewish signs that were all around. And they put pressure on Hitler to say, look, you got to take these signs down for the Olympics. And at first, Hitler was kind of pushing back and saying, oh, you know, you wouldn't go walk into someone's house and tell them what to serve you for dinner. But in the end, he realized that he needed to try to get these anti-Jewish sentiments dialed back and not so obvious, at least during the Olympic moment. And that Olympic moment became known as the Olympic pause, that you didn't see as much explicit anti-Jewish signage. But right after the Olympics, when everybody went home after Berlin 1936, everything returned with a vengeance.
Coming back to the present day and age, we can certainly draw parallels between Berlin 1936, Nazism, and the present-day nation-state of Saudi Arabia, which has spread its tentacles far and wide, all across the sporting arena in the entire world, and is spearheaded by its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman.
This has been a plan for a long time. This is part of their Vision 2030. Sports play a really big role in the future of Saudi Arabia, and they've made no secret about it. It's not some secret plan. They've been very upfront about this, hosting a variety of mini mega events, as they're called, sort of smaller big events. They're also slated to host the 2029 Asian Winter Games. Yes, you heard me right, Winter Games in Saudi Arabia. They're going to do that in 2029. And so this has been part of a larger plan. And when Mohammed bin Salman, who you mentioned, was asked about this, he was open. He said that, yeah, he will continue doing sports washing. I mean, that's a quote from him. He will continue doing sports washing, and he doesn't care about accusations of sports washing.
While the Nazis performed sports washing by hosting events at home, present-day sports washers, Saudi Arabia, have gone one step further.
That both of the regimes engaged in sports washing. Hitler was pretty early on, but he had some innovations. Now you see Saudi Arabia much later, you know, a full century later almost, that has also had some innovations. If you think about the way that Saudi Arabia has done sports washing, it's not just by hosting mega events or events of sports in their country. It's also buying up clubs in other countries. It's sort of a form of settler colonialism, if you will. If you look at the English Premier League of football, where they've purchased the Newcastle United team.
Not just in the United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia's presence can even be felt across the pond in the United States, where US President Joe Biden has become an ally and was last year seen fist bumping Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
U.S. President Joe Biden has been a bit player in Mohammed bin Salman's sports washing master plans. From that conspicuous fist bump that you mentioned to his relative quietude in the face of human rights atrocities, Biden has not deigned to make Mohammed bin Salman a pariah, as he promised to do when he was on the campaign trail.
As the nation-state of Saudi Arabia continues to brew a dangerous mix of power, politics, and sport, one question begs to be asked: can and will they be stopped?
And this is not going away anytime soon. They are slated to host numerous events moving forward. And like we've been talking about, very probably going to host the 2034 Men's World Cup. So this is the kind of thing that we're going to be talking about for the more than the next decade. And there's no reason why it would change, especially because there's little pressure from the International Olympic Committee, FIFA, these other governing bodies of sports, to try to change it. They're perfectly happy to take these infusions of cash to run their events, and they don't worry that much. Now, where you might see pushback is from nature itself. I mean, we're living in the era of climate change, and some of these events just might be impossible to hold in places like Saudi Arabia without exacerbating climate disruption. And so who knows, maybe Mother Nature, if you will be the one force that could intervene to stop the sports washing that we're seeing out of Saudi Arabia. But this is an issue that's going to be on our collective table for quite a long time to come.